the Zoom people tonight? Wow.
Yeah.
What's with that? Is there something on TV or something?
The Olympics?
Well, maybe. Weird. All right. let's see. So I will go around and greet those of you on Zoom, you stalwart souls. Starting with Mick, Marv,
Karen,
Paul,
Jeff,
Bob,
Tyler.
Zach,
Phil,
Paulette, Linda R,
Drew,
Sabrina, and Ruth Ann, and in the Zendo,
Dave,
Rex,
Joan,
Erica,
Coral,
Domio. All right. Let's see, in terms of announcements, I guess I'll talk up, in terms of announcements, I'm also going to talk about it during class, but Sunday is our annual Nahon ceremony. So in place of our usual Sunday chanting service, we will have a ceremony commemorating the Buddha's death. And I'm going to talk about it more tonight, and Kyogen talked about it in this chapter, so I won't go into more about it right now. Let's see. It's not too late to sign up for Term Student. That is a program, if you've already been involved with the Sangha for a couple months at least, because, you know, you got to know that this is your thing before you sign up for this program. The opening retreat is Saturday, February 26th, and the closing retreat is May 14th, I believe. And in between there, this group of people, it's probably going to be about 8 to 10 people, probably. You create your own vows for the term, and we're going to make a little bit better effort to stay in touch this term, particularly when, you know, we don't end up seeing each other in person here. We need a little bit more ways to connect. So I'm going to encourage term students to participate in the Saturday Sangha check-ins if possible. Not all of them necessarily, but as a way to stay in touch. And also we will have our own, we have our own email list for the term, and I'm going to encourage people to do a weekly reflection of some kind. Doesn't have to be long, but some kind of reflection to stay in touch. And then at the end of term, of course, we come back together and we reflect on the term and how our vows went. And many people find it is an added encouragement to stick with your intentions over the course of the term. But also you get to know other people in the Sangha better. So encourage you to consider being part of that. There is a whole page on the website about it. I think there's a link to it in the very top menu, Term Student Program, and it's in the newsletter as well. All right. So tonight. Tonight we are continuing with our study of this book, You Are Still Here, by Kyogen Carlson, one of my teachers. And I ended up skipping a few chapters from what we did the precepts last week, but I skipped the next few chapters because we're going to be studying the precepts in depth starting the end of March. So I just skipped those, and in a very, very appropriate and timely way, this chapter is on the Buddha's death. So it's, you know, and Nahon is Sunday, so it worked out perfectly. Um, So I did, I will take a moment, as promised, to ask if there's any questions or comments from previous classes or chapters. All right. So let's see. Okay, so let me briefly cover our Sunday ceremony. Kyogen describes the Neihan ceremony in the chapter, but I will describe what we will do on Sunday. So it's in place of our chanting service. So the chanting service usually starts at 9:30 and goes till 10. So it'll be before Zazen at that time. And we, all of our Zen ceremonies are more or less the same. They involve chanting and bowing, and when they're participatory, what it usually involves is like processing up and down the rows of cushions in the zendo in such a way that everybody passes by the altar, which is made up special for the occasion. So for Zagaki, we have a special altar, the Festival of the Hungry Ghost. Oh, and I, there's too many things for me to remember. I was going to go get the Neihan statue, which is the little statue of the Buddha reclining, which we will put on the altar in front of this Buddha, or replace this Buddha. And the Neihan sculpture, the sculpture of the Buddha as he's dying, is in front of a screen. And behind the screen is a candle. And it's hidden from view. And at a certain point in the ceremony, which we do, we don't do typical Japanese chanting for this ceremony. Well, we do one typical chant, but one of them is a kind of a Gregorian kind of chant, a plain song chant that my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, wrote. It's using traditional Zen language, but this is not how Japanese people do it. But she was trained as an organist in the Church of England. So that's where she had musical, religious music training. And so this is a very beautiful piece that I will sing, and you can join in on Zoom, but we can't hear you. People in the Zendo will join in as best they can. And at a certain point in the ceremony, we stop and we turn off all the lights and blow out all the candles. So there's this sense of, the Buddha has now died. But then somebody takes a taper, and the light behind the screen is still lit. And they light the taper and relight the candles, and we turn the lights back up. So the Dharma of this is that even though we're human beings and we can't do this without one another, and we have attachments to one another, and there's a certain kind of sadness and grief there, the path is what matters, in the sense that Buddhism does not depend on the Buddha being around. That was his main message on his deathbed, was like, you don't need me anymore. I've given you what you need. You've got the path. And so basically people just pass that down through the generations to each other in this way. Sangha passes it to Sangha. So from now on, the Dharma is your teacher. So we relight the lights and do some more chanting. And as people process in the Zendo, everybody has a chance to go by that altar with the Neihan statue and make some kind of offering. And what we tend to offer are little lavender petals. Traditionally, you do powdered incense on charcoal, and the room would get really smoky. But as a nod to allergies and asthma and various things like that, we do the lavender petals, and we sprinkle them in water. So it has a sweet lesson to it, Also, I think Kyogen makes a good point in this chapter about how the part of the message is that our way is not to escape impermanence, but to embrace it. So unlike many religions, many spiritual paths, the main focus is on, living a good life, but in order to be reborn somewhere or, attain an afterlife where then things will be permanent. So it's impermanent right now, but you're going to escape this impermanence and go to a permanent place of refuge. Whereas Buddhists say, because there's even a Buddhist heaven, right? But we say, well, it doesn't last. You might be reborn in heaven for a while, but then eventually you're reborn somewhere else. So there is no refuge from impermanence, but we say that is okay. Like, there can be a refuge within impermanence by simply embracing impermanence. We also say that Buddhism is the great matter of life and death. And we mean this literally, and we'll be talking more about the aspects of that that Kyogen brings up. Literally, and over the course of our lives, birth and death being things that arise and pass away in periods of our life, and things that we gain and things that we lose, but also moment to moment. So I wanted to have a short breakout small group sessions about a particular passage that I thought was really thought-provoking and moving. So Kyogen is talking about, and this isn't so important, I'm just giving you a little setup, on page 138, he's talking about, as people approach death, the habit energy of their lives is what remains. All the niceties we can put on over ourselves, the faces we put on, are stripped away, and we are like the Buddha on his deathbed. That's why we repeat things the way we do. We want to bring it into our bones. It's clear to me that you really need to make a good life, a life of practice, and bring it into you as a habit energy, a pattern, to really make a good death. Because how you live is how you die. My father died a really graceful death because of how he lived his life. He was a very gentle man who was in non-opposition to things as they are. That's how he died. I watched my mother die, and it was her habit energy that was there. It was true for my stepmother too. They departed with difficulty or grace depending on how they lived their lives. And this is the part that I really wanted to focus on. But to make a good life, you have to make a good death. By that, I mean a daily life of letting go, of dying to self over and over. Our expectations die, hope and dreams die. Moment by moment, what we have passes away. When we are in harmony with that, we are learning how to die over and over and over. Dying to self is practice. Grace and dignity arise from that. Saying yes with open hands in all conditions is moving into birth and death in a very profound way. So by that, I mean a daily life of letting go, of dying to self over and over. Dying to self is practice. Saying yes with open hands in all conditions is moving into birth and death in a very profound way. So I was hoping that people could talk to one another about, what does it mean to die to self over and over? And why use the terminology of birth and death when talking about letting go? mean, to some extent, you know, that makes sense. We need to let go. If we're upset about something, you know, it doesn't help to hold on to it. So, you know, we let it go. But, you know, what, where is this like birth and death terminology? Why is that interesting or useful? And what does letting go have to do with self? So pretty, in a pretty open way, just what is dying to self over and over? And why do we use this terminology of birth and death? So I believe those of you on Zoom are set up to go to breakout rooms, and I don't know, do you guys want to stay in a group of five rather than breaking into like three and two?
Sure.
But go ahead and circle up, and I'm going to leave, you know, extract myself. Go ahead, Mick.
All right, here we go.
And just 10 minutes.
Okay, 10 minutes. Thank you.
All right, so I'm hoping that y'all heard and said some interesting stuff, and a few people might want to share. What does it mean to die to the self over and over? Why would we put it that way?
Well, I guess I made that the focus of what I talked about, and I guess what I think it means is, you know, all the time you've got this voice in your head. Maybe it's not like a literal voice, but you've got something always pulling at you, saying, "I want, you know, I want this, I want that, I want this other thing," and so I think of maybe one way of describing the self is like this voice that says, "I want." And so, you know, allowing that to die is like not listening to that voice, or having it whisper more quietly in your ear rather than yank you around.
Thank you. And Dave and the Zendo here.
So we said a lot of things, but I think to sum it up, we were talking a lot about what we mean by self. Like, you know, we all carry ideas of ourself, what comprises you. You have your own self, you know, your vision of yourself. We have the self that the world reflects back to you, people tell you. And as we try and let go of those things, it can be a scary process, because If you let all that stuff go, then where are you now? Mm-hmm. And it can feel like a process of dying in that way. That I, you know, yesterday thought I was this, I thought it was that, and as I let that go, I kind of diminish in a certain way. And I don't know, did I miss anything?
No, that was good.
Cool.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I guess I kind of like stumbled over in our breakout room was, you know, what am I without all my stuff? And so maybe just like every moment, I'll just drag all my stuff from the past with me, and then I'm still me, right? Like if I'm still that comfortable me that I have narratives about, and mostly unchanged if I just keep dragging all the stuff from the past into the future every moment, instead of just letting, you know, dying to the self and just letting all of that go.
Paula?
I don't know. I mean, I'm struggling with this a little bit, but Like, sometimes I feel like the things that I love and the people and the, like, animals that I love are what give me meaning. So, like, if I just kind of moment by moment just to let it pass and everything's transient, I mean, it's a little hard because it's like that's what I think gives my life purpose, is that I am able to love others. And in some way, like, I'm shaped by their love, they're shaped by my love. And so some of this is a little hard for me to understand because I can't just passively watch things just pass and not have any reaction to it.
Yeah, what is that? What is that? What is just love and sincerity, and what is not fighting impermanence, fighting life and death? Zach.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I think we touched on. And it was, you know, it's not, we're not saying like you shouldn't have feelings, but when life happens, like he says, to be in harmony with it, and don't struggle against what's happening, don't fight against life, but just have that acceptance of, like, this is the situation, this is where I'm at.
Yeah, you make me think of, you know, my husband is a lot older than I am. He's 22 years older than I am, and he smokes. And anyway, like, I could, I could spend a lot of time worrying about that, and, you know, the most likely sad and painful scenarios that the next 10, 15 years holds for me. And, you know, talk about, you know, everything changing. And I guess when I feel like I'm practicing this the best is when, like, I'm falling asleep with my arm around him and I'm like, we're still here. You know? It's like, right now, we are still here. And, like, I don't want to ruin it by thinking about or preparing for or emotionally, even, you know, to some extent, we might even, like, you know, distort this teaching in a way by trying to use it to kind of emotionally deaden ourselves, right? So that we're preparing for death so that we won't be upset by anything because we've stopped caring about anything, but as if that's even possible. But, you know, keeping our hearts open and recognizing our hearts are gonna break, but I don't know, in a way maybe you could say that is what the Buddha's radical realization was. So he looked around him and he said, God, it just seems like we're just doomed to, like, when things are going well, yay, we're great. But then inevitably old age, disease, death, loss comes to us and we're devastated. And it seems so you know, unstable, so upsetting. And, you know, was there anything we could do about it? And many of the religious folks of his time said, you know, you can attain some kind of spiritual state, you know, or you won't care anymore, or, you know, you can pray and do ceremonies and then you'll be reborn in a particular life and that'll be great. But it's also, he went a different route and said, if you just stop resisting the way that life is, you stop resisting the impermanence, that actually there's an ease that can come. that we create more. I mean, that, yeah, like there's that difference between pain, the pain which is inevitably going to happen with our loss and our old age and disease and death and all that, but we add the suffering by it through the resistance. I was also thinking about how so there's different ways. I mean, when you really, if you start to talk about the self, and I don't, I'm, sounds like a couple groups at least did, you realize like, what the heck is the self? You could, once you start looking for it, it's like, well, wait, it's this sense that, what? So it's like, from the Buddhist point of view, we do have a, what we call like a conventional self, right? I mean, yeah, you've got a body, you've got a life, you've got relationships, you've got karma, you've got a personality, you've got all of these things taken in collection are a meaningful parcel of things, which we should take responsibility for, take care of, whatever. We have to function. And we might have a sense of our a sense of ourselves in that way. We need that. But then we have this delusion of a permanent self nature. We have this delusion of this inherent, enduring, independent essence that is in the middle of all of it and has remained in the middle of all of it through the years and will be in the middle of all of it when things change in the future. And that if you look closely at that sense that there is a real me in here, and you look closely, I think it's kind of like what Mick was saying. That sense is nothing other than resistance to impermanence. That self is, another way to put it, the Buddha put it in terms of desire, right? It's desire for the things that we identify with, we like, we enjoy, we think of as part of ourselves, all this, or we don't, you know, resisting what we don't identify with, we don't like that, that's not part of me, that's not part of my life. And that very, and it makes sense from the point of view of natural selection, right? There's like, there's just this sense in us that's just looking out for our self-interest. I like this, I don't like that, I like this, I don't like that, I like this, you know, just navigating constantly. In the sense that is all that is. That sense of inherently existing self is nothing but a bundle of desire. So when we let go of desire, even if it's just for a moment, right? Even if it's just like, I, rather than, you know, getting all upset, I'm just going to breathe, or, you know, rather than fighting this or getting all freaked out about it or depressed about it, I'm going to try to just come to terms with the way things are, whatever. Whenever we let go of this resistance to impermanence, we are letting go of self. There's a real death that happens, because that we're just going like this with that sense of self, which then we find out that's okay. We don't actually need, I mean, to some extent we need it, right? We need it. It's useful as we go about our daily lives. We like this, we don't like that. We identify with this, we don't identify with that. But we recognize it's just a sense. It's just a sense that it arises in us. It's not it. It's not inherently true. It's not inherently us. It's just a sense that we have. I don't know if that made any sense. Linda.
Yes. building on what you said and also what Paulette brought up, like, I have pets that I just adore, you know, and I don't really like thinking about, you know, and I've had other pets that have died, you know, and I love them all dearly, and it's really, really hard, you know, or you know, thinking about my husband perhaps passing before I do. You know, I feel sadness around my brother's best friend who's dying of cancer, someone I've known for probably 40 years, you know. So I know that it's inevitable that people are going to die, but what about sadness and grief? Are those forms of resistance? Because I know that I don't think I'd ever be someone who doesn't have sadness and grief over losing a pet or a human that I care about.
I would say that grief is a kind of very extremely painful but also very pure emotional pain. And pain in that sense that it is not dukkha. We could add dukkha if we want. But I think of it in terms of like, and actually to some extent the grief we experience when we lose not just people or beings, but lose, you know, relationships, experiences, abilities, when we lose things, that in some ways is a lesson in, I mean, no self is one way to put it, but a better way in this case is to put boundless self. You are not this little essence in here, right? You are dependently co-arisen with all of this and all of these people. They are part of you. It doesn't end at your skin. They are part of you. So when you lose them, it's be the same as like you lose a limb. Dang, you know, it's traumatic. It's shocking. It's painful. It is going to take, you know, some adaptation. It's just a completely natural kind of pain. So that's what I think about in terms of grief. And I think it's a subtle question to like, well, you know, what would it look like to start adding dukkha, to start adding resistance to grief? But I think grief is probably one of the purest of our painful emotions. But grief before we've lost someone, I don't know. I mean, they can have this anticipatory kind of, I'm afraid of losing, and thereby actually detract from the here and now because of our fear of loss.
Yeah, I find for me that's a balancing act. Definitely. Thank you for your explanation and insight.
Others are welcome to speak up if they have ideas about that as well. Sabrina.
I will take a stab at this. This is very ill-formed because I wasn't expecting the question, but I think for me, anticipatory grief actually somewhat led me to Zen because I noticed it happening and noticed that my reaction was anger for anything that seemed like a waste of time.
Huh.
And so if you can at least have something kind of smack you into noticing, then you stop and notice something else, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and what we're, you know, Kyogen was talking about a lot in this chapter was about this resistance to impermanence. But all at the same time, impermanence itself is, it's like this primary gateway into practice for many of us, maybe all of us, in some form or another, right? Is recognizing loss, recognizing change, illness, old age, death, etc., and going like, wait a second, which is almost like, I remember somebody saying recently that they heard Gyokuko, my teacher at Dharma Rain, we had a children's program, and she talked about keeping the Dharma very light for kids. Because, like, it's, you don't want to get into, like, no self and, you know, the dukkha you're bringing into it and all that kind of stuff, because in a way they still have to learn for themselves, right? They still have to be excited about life and go out there and try it and taste it and, you know, try for this and enjoy that. And then at some point, inevitably, right, realizing, this isn't quite doing it. And then the motivation for practice arises. Of course, you know, some of us have experiences earlier that make us start thinking along those lines, but
people who have been grief counselors, experienced people will say that grief is a skill, especially in cultures that are death-denying, which ours is. And the Dalai Lama said, you know, our emotions are our gateway to enlightenment, so we don't bury our emotions. We need to be in a self-care situation when we're thrown by unexpected emotions around grief. But in the point, we all hope to be more present. So as we're with a loved one, to say, these are the moments I love best. They could change tomorrow. They could change next year. We could change, and maybe not our pets or our children, not as much as we are. So it's this dance with enjoy the present, and we have to keep reminding ourselves of that all the time. And when we enjoy it, I think it's when it's easier to look at, okay, we're enjoying it because it is impermanent. And it can be a daily reminder that it's okay. Thank you.
Thank you. There are a few minutes left. I wanted to talk a little bit about the aspect of the chapter. And I guess, you know, I could talk more about the Buddha's passing and the lesson in that, but I guess I'll cover that some more on Sunday when we do the Nehan ceremony. But this piece about, he talked about the habit energy of his dad, for instance, and just noticing how, what did he say? How you live is how you die. So I wanted to throw out this idea that preparing for our own death is a useful practice. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, there can be a whole spectrum of practices there. I mean, you could get really into it, really into it. And that's fun, you know, that's cool too. Like, you know, what do you want to have happen and contemplating and whatever. But it doesn't have to be It doesn't have to be a morbid or explicit thing. If you think of it in terms of, like, death is part of life, so it's not a matter of, like, I'm not going to pay attention to living because I'm obsessed with death. But living in the context, you know, living your life in the context of, like, it is going to end. I'm not here forever. Life is short. And therefore, you know, who do I want to become? How do I want to live it? What kind of habits do I want to instill in myself? And I'm imagining that many people have had this experience of, if you've been lucky enough to be around someone who is approaching death, and they're really going into the dying process, their world is shrinking and whatever, that the habits of a lifetime are there with you, as he said with his mom. He didn't say in the chapter that his mom didn't die as what did he say, like, gracefully as his dad. He didn't say that in the chapter, but that was definitely the case. And I personally, when I think about, you know, well, how am I likely to die, assuming it's not an instant thing, right, and there's a process, I don't know. I hope, but when I think about it, it really puts into like, kind of stark definition the work I still have to do, because I may think, fine every day, yeah, but then when I think about, like, well, what habits are going to be left, and I'm kind of afraid that if I get dementia and I'm in a nursing home, I'm going to be one of those people that's going to be, like, getting out of bed and buzzing around because I think I have something to do. Like, I know I have something to do. There's something I'm not doing. There's something I've got to finish. And I'm like, oh, no, I don't want that to, like, be who I am. You know, so it really makes me reflect on, like, right? You know, I want to keep doing things, but how might I hold all of it a little differently in a way that will generate different kinds of habit energy? And I remember encountering a woman in a nursing home who had dementia as well, and she just came up and she said, "Dear, can you tell me what year it is?" And I just thought, like, oh, God, please let that be me, right? Please let that just be, like, I don't really know what's going on anymore. You know, oh, well, what's for lunch? I don't know if anybody has any reflections on, I don't know if experiences with people at the ends of their lives or thoughts on that. You're welcome to raise your hand. I was I wasn't present when Kyogen died because he died of a heart attack very suddenly. But I was one of the first people that Gyokoko called, and the hospital, bless their hearts, they let us all come and visit the body, which is a traditional Zen thing. So they cleaned his body and they dressed it in a white kimono. And, like, I don't know how many people came through there. There's people crying in the halls. And I mean, they basically just let us have this whole wing for the duration, for the whole day. And people were coming, probably like 150 people ended up going through and having time at his bedside and whatever. And I just remember, like, you know, it was very devastating because it had this sense that he was so, I don't know, so vital and so brilliant and so generous that you, like, no, it's too soon. He was supposed to live for another, like, 20, 30 years, right? He was supposed to still be here. But despite that, that sense of loss and grief and devastation and everything, it was like, I just had this sense that if he was like looking down, he'd just be like, it's cool, it's all right. I mean, it felt so clean. It just felt like there was nothing. And I even had a difficult relationship with him at times, but I really felt like, you know, he lived in such a way that off he went. So I hold him as an example of a good death. Guess I'll leave it there. offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All but us throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Domio.